I need to start putting the sermon after boring parts of the service. You know, I was like, first your daughter dances, now a song, and here we go. Thank you so very, very much. How good it is to be with you. Last week I saw from attending to my colleagues on Facebook that many of them jumped right into speaking about this shooting that happened in Tucson. It was just the day before or so. We mentioned it in the prayer last week. And for me, it felt too soon. I'm the sort of introvert who needs to chew and stew. It struck me as rather ironic that almost immediately we entered a round of divisive talking about divisive talking, that we heard all sorts of condemnations of condemnation. Always, of course, the condemnation that the others express. And the conversation, such as it is nationally, has raised important topics for us to consider as a people: gun control, mental health, the nature of our public discourse. I guess I feel ready in King's memory and spirit to say a word about this. Divisive talking about divisive talking. Oh, so very natural for us, not just as individuals, but as a people. Human beings struggle. The history of this nation is actually one of the struggle for its soul, of conflict for the very beginning. From the very beginning, the same sorts of conflicts we've been playing out as people since the dawn of time. Competing energies and understandings of what it is to be a people and what the point of this land is. And sometimes, often even, as we spread across the nation and subjugated its native peoples, there has been a martial quality to that struggle, and it's actually nothing new. Usually I draw comfort from the fact that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And maybe we can know that we're not actually in new territory here. Even Sarah Palin, speaking of this generation's bitter partisan debate, asked, when was it less heated? Back in those calm days when political figures literally settled their differences with dueling pistols? And she's right. Or canes to the head? Or hoses, or dogs. We have been in the midst of a religious and moral struggle from the beginning. Part of the promise of this land and its philosophy has been this expansive, universalist quality of a land of freedom for all people. And simultaneously, from the time of the founders on, there has always been present an us-only side as well. Of, thank goodness we've got all the land so I can do whatever I want, or we, our separate group, can do what we want. And that there have been times when that group has had the whole say. There have always been those in our history whose understanding of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has been a strictly private affair, whose understanding of freedom is strictly freedom from anybody else ever bothering me or telling me what to do. But there have simultaneously always been those leaning toward the common good who remembered that our hopes and dreams are always bound together, as the president said. And this struggle, this discord, this split can be found sometimes even in a single person. I simply lift up Thomas Jefferson, composer of a document that still brings tears to my eyes with its values of liberty and freedom, and yet who wrote it, owning over 200 slaves. His is the split personality of our nation. In the videos we've been watching on Wednesday, one of the beautiful things about them, Race, the Power of an Illusion, is it shows how America has tried to grapple with this split between a principle of equality for all and a reality that did not accord with that. And the problem is we have had a very hard time having an honest, real conversation about that at any time. By the time folks began to consider the race problem in the 1800s, we learned slavery had already been established. And the best liberal scientific minds of the day were left wondering, why is it that the African people seemed to be so much less capable than the whites? And they drafted a science of race that we now acknowledge as completely false to justify it. That wasn't really facing the problem. Even the Civil War didn't solve the problem. And we certainly haven't solved the problem today. When certain members of Congress, believing that the Founding Fathers were somehow prescient about any possibility of a future modern democratic state, modern state that we live in now, these foundationalists who insisted that we read the Constitution because everything has to be reflected through its lens, decided to leave out the parts about slavery. I guess we couldn't admit that maybe the Founding Fathers were wrong about that, which seems like step one to me. And our inability today to have an honest conversation, forgive me if I offend you, is that apparently you are not even allowed to say the word nigger in order to say that it is the worst word you can say. Instead, we have to not talk about it by saying the N-word, even though I hear it in my son's rap music all the time. That's split personality. King provoked an honest conversation about race for a period of time, growing deeper in his criticism, demanding that we look unflinchingly at our history, pushing us, as a prophet does, to look at the way our institutions and power structures perpetuate inequality and indignity. But even today, the way he is remembered does not often take that into account. It's not full and honest. He's become an individual hero rather than part of an enormous group of people. We all want to recreate him, as we so often do with prophets, in our own image. Glenn Beck wants to turn Martin Luther King into Glenn Beck. Not good. So we don't talk about it, our guilt being too great, or the polarizing powers too powerful for now, or our faith in our nation, or the power of love that King preached too weak. That was why I was so grateful for our president's speech in response to this. Because at least there was a little bit of talking about it, about this split personality, and demonstrated in a way that showed humility and, most importantly, showed respect for the people who died as individuals, not as topics of a debate. He told us, and I agree, that we must learn to talk to each other in a way that heals, not a way that wounds, with humility. That we cannot use this as one more occasion to turn on each other, that we must expand our moral imagination and have a civil and more honest discourse that will finally enable us to face our challenges. And perhaps most movingly, when speaking of that 9-year-old girl who still dreamed the dream we dream of this land, that we must do everything we can to make sure this country lives up to our children's expectations. I was so grateful for those words. But because I know this split personality, I was also not surprised, though deeply troubled, by some of the comments on the YouTube page where I watched the president's speech. Right at the top, "You effing ape. Having a pep rally at a memorial, you make me sick." What do you do with that? A simple call for civility or politeness is not going to tap into this person's mind. Frank Rich, just yesterday in the New York Times, said, "Calls for civility, they have no lasting impact. They didn't change the tone of American discourse, and they won't change it any more now than they did after the JFK assassination, or King's assassination, or after Oklahoma City, or after 9/11. Especially not in an era," he writes, "where technology allows all 300 million Americans a cost-free megaphone for unmediated rants." Amen. And he feared that as soon as the president left the podium, we would shift into our familiar, quote, spin-dry, post-tragedy cycle of the modern era. Speedy closure, followed by a return to business as usual, followed by our pervasive case of national amnesia. It's hard to know what to do with an unwillingness or inability to listen, an inability or unwillingness to engage in critical thinking, another's inability or unwillingness to assume the best about other people, to just assume, as we must, that even our gravest political opponents are acting in a human way, that there's something human and understandable about the position people take. I just know I'm done with battle as a way of solving problems. And though I grow as frustrated as anyone, angry with the shouting and hyperbole and bullying that we find on talk radio and TV, and I just turn it off. I don't know if that's the solution. I don't think it is. We have to somehow address incivility without becoming uncivil ourselves. We have to name and confront wrong speech using right speech. We have to, as King taught again and again, confront the power of hate and violence with the power of love and peace. It's clear that an argument isn't going to get us there, or a change of tone. Mere reason is not going to get us there. King was fond of liberalism. He wrote, there's one phase, this is not political left-wingism, but this quality of our national personality that is about freedom, and in his words, about a devotion to the search for truth, the insistence on an open mind, the refusal to abandon the best light of reason. He said, I hope to always cherish that. But he saw the liberal perspective as falsely idealistic and sentimental, and with too rosy a view of human nature that showed we can always use, whoever we are, we can use the power of reason extremely skillfully to rationalize our actions, whatever they are. Because we have this tragic inclination, we're not gods. So reason becomes sometimes just another instrument to justify our own defensive ways of thinking. He said, devoid of the purifying power of faith, we can't trust it. It will never be completely free from distortions and rationalizations. That's a pit anybody can fall in. He said, don't confuse the kingdom of God with any particular economic or social order. And I would add, don't confuse it with a certain amount of education or having read the right books or following a certain profession, or any other worldly thing. So if we can't turn to yet another argument, what do we turn to? As a deeply religious person, King turned to the sacred. He turned to the power of God and the example of Gandhi and found love power, truth power, satyagraha, as Gandhi defined it, that power of truth-seeking, nonviolent, loving people to, with their bodies and their will, overcome any obstacle, to put their bodies on the line. And that position of love first and nonviolent expression thereof is the way we can learn to act with faith, hope, and dignity at a time such as this. Obama said in his speech, the forces that divide us are not as strong as the forces that unite us. I believe it with all my heart, and I think it runs all the way down to the atoms. And that was surely a tenet of King's faith, too. Early in his career, as befitted a good Boston theologian, which he was, he kept it vague. Some power of the universe, he said. Some force. Whether you call it an unconscious process or the unmoved mover or a personal God, moves us toward justice. And that faith deepened later in his career, tempered by his struggle and his frustration. He had come to an experience and understanding of God in a much deeper way that could sustain him when he could no longer sustain himself. He spoke of it in a much more personal way. It was striking to me, so much my own experience as well. He said that power was real enough to offer us companionship if we were open to finding it in the struggle. It works because taking that posture of nonviolence first changes us. We first become a new being in the world, with our commitment to that way. And out of that, he experienced strength and courage that he did not know he had. Then, when that has happened in us, then that power, when it will face down the dogs and face down the hoses, must ultimately, he believed, and I believe it too, reach the opponent and so stir his conscience that reconciliation becomes a reality. And acting in this way as well, not only do we honor our own dignity, but we honor the dignity of those we oppose. Garth Baker Fletcher, Harvard grad, summarized King's position on human dignity as granting people somebody-ness. Somebody-ness. That everybody was somebody. But that wasn't more than just an inherent quality. We share a faith that he expressed many times, that every person has inherent worth and dignity. But King went on well beyond that and said dignity was also something you do. It's a process. It's a way of acting. When you act with dignity, dignity itself emerges in you. So you can't just leave it there and hope for the best. You have to do something. What do? In his last sermon, he dismissed all his prizes and awards with a wave of the hand. "Please, in my eulogy," he said, "don't mention the Nobel Prize or all those frames on the wall. I just want people to say, I did the right thing. I fed my hungry neighbor. I clothed my naked neighbor. I lived the gospel of service. I did God's will." Dignity was an act. So how do we act with dignity in these times? First, following King, we organize. Let's heal up the fella on the side of the road and take him to the Jericho Road Improvement Association. Hear what he has to say. Work together. And do so inclusively. This is the wonderful miracle of King and the beauty of his writing that stirs us even to this day, is that white people and black people, as much as he felt for and worked for his people, whites were never excluded from his vision. We were in an inescapable net of mutuality and relationship, he said, and that is such a difference from the rhetoric of today, when our opponents are named as vile or un-American or traitors or fascists or communists or Muslims or whatever. King told a story in 1968 about being in jail again. He was in Birmingham. He was talking to the white jailers. And he said, on the first day, they all came by and did their fine Southern duty to tell him why the civil rights movement was doomed and why they needed to be patient and why segregation was justified. And he said they did their part. It's kind of a funny story, actually, the way he wrote it. He said, and I couldn't help myself. I did my part and preached for a day or two at them. But come the third day, I guess they'd run out of steam, and somebody actually asked, you know, hey, where do you live? What's your life like? What's being a prison guard like? And they started to talk about their lives. And by the end of that conversation, Martin said, you fellows are poorer than the Negroes in your town. You need to come and join us. And that inclusiveness and that willingness to stretch his work into the economic realm and into the social realm and to look more deeply at all our social institutions, that marked the beauty of his late career. Join us then. Be included, he said. Don't give up the faith. We're talking about a person who died from a bullet, even as we now still pray for someone who we hope will live from such a wound, Representative Giffords, and mourn those who died that way. But I do have to say, I don't think the shooting of those people in Tucson is in the same category as Dr. King's death. I wouldn't call it an assassination. When a deeply troubled, unwell, broken person commits an act like this, this is something no change in discourse or anything is ever going to completely end. Instead, the shooting of Gabby Giffords is more like an incident from earlier in King's life that I did not remember. In 1958, after some talk, an African-American woman approached him, said, "Are you Martin Luther King?" He said, "Yes." and she stabbed him in the chest. The blade went inches or less, millimeters from his aorta. And the doctors later told him, he recovered in a Boston hospital, that if he had sneezed, he would have died, because the wound was so close, he would have bled into himself, and that would have been that. And he said after that event happened, he got a telegraph from the president and all these other folk. He didn't exactly remember what they said, but what he did remember was a letter he got from a ninth grade girl. She wrote, "I shouldn't have to say this, and it shouldn't matter, but I'm a white girl from California or wherever it was, and I just felt I had to write you to tell you I'm glad you didn't sneeze." And he said, "Oh, in this speech, I'm so glad I didn't sneeze, because if I had, I would have not seen all of the brave people, all of his brave people, sitting at the counters and protesting the buses and marching in the streets and making the work of justice real." Now, if Representative Giffords lives, and it looks like she may, I don't know that she shares King's complete commitment to nonviolence in the same way. He turned out to be against really all war by the end of his life. She's one of the most centrist legislators in Congress. But knowing what I've read about her, I would say, I bet when she wakes up, she's not going to call for revenge. She's not going to say, let's put targets on somebody else's district. She's not going to even call for the repeal of the Second Amendment, though her views may modify slightly. What she's going to do if she lives is provide with her body a condemnation of the path of violence, and I believe from the way she's acted in the past, she will pursue what Obama called our never-ending process toward a more perfect union. And that should give us hope in this power of love, in the power of forgiveness, in the power of facing forward. And if you don't believe it, remember, it's worked before. King believed it because it worked for Gandhi, and we can believe it because it worked for King. We've seen it work, love. So let's put it to work. Remembering, as Cornel West said, justice is what love looks like in public. So may love bless the United States of America and all the nations and peoples of this earth. Amen. And let's conclude that by reading King's words together. If you'll find 584 in your hymnal and respond with the italics.